It was a cold, grey day near the end of December. The east wind was streaming through the bare branches of the trees and seething in the dark pines on the hills. Ragged clouds were hurrying overhead, dark and low. As the cheerless shadows of the early evening began to fall, the company made ready to set out. They were to start at dusk, for Elrond counseled them to journey under cover of night as often as they could until they were far from Rivendell. "You should fear the many eyes of the servants of Sauron," he said. "I do not doubt that news of the discomfiture of the riders has already reached him, and he will be filled with wrath. Soon now his spies on foot and wing will be abroad in the northern lands. Even of the sky above you must beware as you go on your way." The company took little gear of war, for their hope was in secrecy, not in battle. Aragorn had Undúril, but no other weapon, and he went forth clad only in rusty green and brown, as a ranger of the wilderness. Boromir had a long sword, in fashion like Undúril, but of less lineage, and he bore also a shield and his war-horn.
"Loud and clear it sounds in the valleys of the hills," he said. "And then let all the foes of Gondor flee."
Putting it to his lips, he blew a blast, and the echoes leapt from rock to rock, and all that heard that voice in Rivendell sprang to their feet. "Slow should you be to wind that horn again, Boromir," said Elrond, "until you stand once more on the borders of your land, and dire need is on you."
"Maybe," said Boromir, "but always I've let my horn cry at setting forth, and though thereafter we may walk in the shadows, I will not go forth as a thief in the night."
Gimli the dwarf alone wore openly a short shirt of steel rings, for dwarves make light of burdens, and in his belt was a broad-bladed axe. Legolas had a bow and a quiver, and at his belt a long white knife. The younger hobbits wore the swords that they had taken from the barrow, but Frodo took only Sting, and his mail coat, as Bilbo wished, remained hidden. Gandalf bore his staff, but girt at his side was the elven sword Glamdring, the mate of Orcrist that lay now upon the breast of Thorin under the lonely mountain. All were well furnished by Elrond with thick warm clothes, and they had jackets and cloaks lined with fur. Spare food and clothes and blankets and other needs were laden on a pony, none other than the poor beast that they had brought from Bree. The stay in Rivendell had worked a great wonder of change on him. He was glossy and seemed to have the vigour of youth. It was Sam who had insisted on choosing him, declaring that Bill, as he called him, would pine if he didn't come. "That animal can nearly talk," he said, "and would talk if he stayed here much longer. He gave me a look as plain as Mr. Pippin could speak it. If you don't let me go with you, Sam, I'll follow on my own." So Bill was going as the beast of burden, yet he was the only member of the company that didn't seem depressed. Their farewells had been said in the great hall by the fire, and they were only waiting now for Gandalf, who hadn't yet come out of the house. A gleam of firelight came from the open doors, and soft lights were glowing in many windows. Bilbo, huddled in a cloak, stood silent on the doorstep beside Frodo. Aragorn sat with his head bowed to his knees. Only Elrond knew fully what this hour meant to him. The others could be seen as grey shapes in the darkness. Sam was standing by the pony, sucking his teeth, and staring moodily into the gloom where the river roared stonily below. His desire for adventure was at its lowest ebb. "Bill, my lad," he said, "you oughtn't to have took up with us. You could have stayed here and ate the best hay till the new grass comes." Bill swished his tail and said nothing. Sam eased the pack on his shoulders, and went over anxiously in his mind all the things that he had stowed in it, wondering if he had forgotten anything. His chief treasure, his cooking gear, and the little box of salt that he always carried and refilled when he could, a good supply of pipeweed, but not near enough, I'll warrant, flint and tinder, woolen hose, linen, various small belongings of his master's that Frodo had forgotten and Sam had stowed to bring them out in triumph when they were called for. He went through them all. "Rope," he muttered. "No rope. And only last night you said to yourself, 'Sam, what about a bit of rope? You'll want it if you haven't got it.' Well, I'll want it. I can't get it now." At that moment Elrond came out with Gandalf, and he called the company to him. "This is my last word," he said in a low voice. "The Ringbearer is setting out on the quest of Mount Doom. On him alone is any charge laid, neither to cast away the ring, nor to deliver it to any servant of the enemy, nor indeed to let any handle it, save members of the company and the council, and only then in gravest need. The others go with him as free companions to help him on his way. You may tarry, or come back, or turn aside into other paths, as chance allows. The further you go, the less easy will it be to withdraw. Yet no oath or bond is laid on you to go further than you will. For you do not yet know the strength of your hearts, and you cannot foresee what each may meet upon the road."
"Faithless is he that says farewell when the road darkens," said Gimli.
"Maybe," said Elrond, "but let him not vow to walk in the dark who has not seen the nightfall."
"Yet sworn word may strengthen quaking heart," said Gimli.
"Or break it," said Elrond. "Look not too far ahead, but go now with good hearts. Farewell, and may the blessing of elves and men and all free folk go with you. May the stars shine upon your faces."
Good luck," cried Bilbo, stuttering with the cold. "I don't suppose you'll be able to keep a diary, Frodo, my lad, but I shall expect a full account when you get back, and don't be too long. Farewell."
Many others of Elrond's household stood in the shadows and watched them go, bidding them farewell with soft voices. There was no laughter, and no song or music. At last they turned away and faded silently into the dusk. They crossed the bridge and wound slowly up the long, steep paths that led out to the cloven vale of Rivendell, and they came at length to the high moor where the wind hissed through the heather. Then, with one glance at the last homely house twinkling below them, they strode away far into the night. At the ford of Bruinen they left the road and, turning southwards, went on by narrow paths among the folded lands. Their purpose was to hold this course west of the mountains for many miles and days. The country was much rougher and more barren than in the green vale of the great river in Wilderland on the other side of the range, and their going would be slow, but they hoped in this way to escape the notice of unfriendly eyes. The spies of Sauron had hitherto seldom been seen in this empty country, and the paths were little known except to the people of Rivendell. Gandalf walked in front, and with him went Aragorn, who knew the land even in the dark. The others were in file behind, and Legolas, whose eyes were keen, was the rear guard. The first part of their journey was hard and dreary, and Frodo remembered little of it, save the wind. For many sunless days an icy blast came from the mountains in the east, and no garment seemed able to keep out its searching fingers. Though the company was well clad, they seldom felt warm, either moving or at rest. They slept uneasily during the middle of the day, in some hollow of the land, or hidden under the tangled thorn bushes that grew in thickets in many places. In the late afternoon they were roused by the watch, and took their chief meal, cold and cheerless as a rule, for they could seldom risk the lighting of a fire. In the evening they went on again, always as nearly southward as they could find a way. At first it seemed to the hobbits that although they walked and stumbled until they were weary, they were creeping forward like snails, and getting nowhere. Each day the land looked much the same as it had the day before, yet steadily the mountains were drawing nearer. South of Rivendell they rose even higher, and bent westwards, and about the feet of the main range there was tumbled an even wider land of bleak hills and deep valleys filled with turbulent waters. Paths were few and winding, and led them often only to the edge of some sheer fall or down into treacherous swamps. They had been a fortnight on the way when the weather changed. The wind suddenly fell and then veered round to the south. The swift-flowing clouds lifted and melted away, and the sun came out, pale and bright. There came a cold, clear dawn at the end of a long, stumbling night march. The travellers reached a low ridge crowned with ancient holly trees, whose grey-green trunks seemed to have been built out of the very stone of the hills. Their dark leaves shone, and their berries glowed red in the light of the rising sun. Away in the south, Frodo could see the dim shapes of lofty mountains that seemed now to stand across the path that the company was taking. At the left of this high range rose three peaks. The tallest and nearest stood up like a tooth tipped with snow. Its great bare northern precipice was still largely in the shadow, but where the sunlight slanted upon it, it glowed red. Gandalf stood at Frodo's side and looked out under his hand.
"We have done well," he said. "We've reached the borders of the country that men call Holin. Many elves lived here in happier days, when Aurigion was its name. 45 leagues as the crow flies we've come, though many long miles further our feet have walked. The land and the weather will be milder now, but perhaps all the more dangerous."
"Dangerous or not, a real sunrise is mighty welcome," said Frodo, throwing back his hood and letting the morning light fall on his face.
"But the mountains are ahead of us," said Pippin. "We must have turned eastwards in the night."
"No," said Gandalf, "but you see further ahead in the clear light. Beyond those peaks the range bends round southwest. There are many maps in Elrond's house, but I suppose you never thought to look at them."
"Yes, I did, sometimes," said Pippin, "but I don't remember them. Frodo has a better head for that sort of thing."
"I need no map," said Gimli, who had come up with Legolas, and was gazing out before him with a strange light in his deep eyes. "There is the land where our fathers worked of old, and we have wrought the image of those mountains into many works of metal and stone, and into many songs and tales. They stand tall in our dreams. Baraz, Zirak, Shathor. Only once before have I seen them from afar in waking life, but I know them and their names, for under them lies Khazad Dûm, the Dwarodelf, that is now called the Black Pit, Moria in the Elvish tongue. Yonder stands Barazimba, the Redhorn, cruel Carathras, and beyond him a Silverteen and Cloudyhead, Celebdil the White, and Fanwethal the Grey, that we call Zirag-Zigil and Bodo-Shathor. There the misty mountains divide, and between their arms lies the deep-shadowed valley which we cannot forget. Azan-ul-Bezar, the Dimril Dale, which the elves call Nanduhirion.
It is for the Dimril Dale that we are making, said Gandalf. If we climb that pass that is called the Redhorn Gate, under the far side of Carathras, we shall come down by the Dimril Stair into the deep vale of the dwarves. There lies the Miromir, and there the river Silverlode rises in its icy springs. Dark is the water of Cheled Zaram, said Gimli, and cold are the springs of Kibil Nala. My heart trembles at the thought that I may see them soon.
May you have joy at the sight, my good dwarf, said Gandalf.
But whatever you may do, we at least cannot stay in that valley. We must go down the silver lode into the secret woods, and so to the great river, and then... He paused.
Yes, and where then? Asked Merry.
To the end of the journey, in the end, said Gandalf. We cannot look too far ahead. Let us be glad that the first stage is safely over. I think we will rest here, not only today, but tonight as well. There is a wholesome air about Holin. Much evil must befall a country before it wholly forgets the elves, if once they dwelt there.
That is true, said Legolas. But the elves of this land were of a race strange to us of the Sylvan folk, and the trees and the grass do not now remember them. Only I hear the stones lament them. Deep they delved us, fair they wrought us, high they builded us, but they are gone. They are gone. They sought the havens long ago. That morning they lit a fire in a deep hollow shrouded by great bushes of holly, and their supper breakfast was merrier than it had been since they set out. They didn't hurry to bed afterwards, for they expected to have all the night to sleep in, and they didn't mean to go on again until the evening of the next day. Only Aragorn was silent and restless. After a while he left the company and wandered on to the ridge. There he stood in the shadow of a tree, looking out southwards and westwards, with his head posed as if he was listening. Then he returned to the brink of the dell and looked down at the others laughing and talking. "What's the matter, Strider?" Merry called up. "What are you looking for? Do you miss the east wind?"
"No, indeed," he answered. "But I miss something. I've been in the country of Holland in many seasons. No folk dwell here now, but many other creatures live here at all times, especially birds. Yet now all things but you are silent. I can feel it. There is no sound for miles about us, and your voices seem to make the ground echo. I don't understand it."
Gandalf looked up with sudden interest.
"But what do you guess is the reason?" he asked. "Is there more in it than surprise at seeing four hobbits, not to mention the rest of us, where people are so seldom seen or heard?"
"I hope that's it," answered Aragorn. "But I have a sense of watchfulness and of fear that I have never had here before."
"Then we must be more careful," said Gandalf. "If you bring a ranger with you, it's well to pay attention to him, especially if the ranger is Aragorn. We must stop talking aloud, rest quietly, and set the watch."
It was Sam's turn that day to take the first watch, but Aragorn joined him. The others fell asleep. Then the silence grew until even Sam felt it. The breathing of the sleepers could be plainly heard. The swish of the pony's tail and the occasional movements of his feet became loud noises. Sam could hear his own joints creaking if he stirred. Dead silence was around him, and over all hung a clear blue sky as the sun rode up from the east. Away in the south a dark patch appeared, and grew, and drove north like flying smoke in the wind.
"What's that, Strider? He don't look like a cloud," said Sam in a whisper to Aragorn.
He made no answer. He was gazing intently at the sky, but before long Sam could see for himself what was approaching. Flocks of birds, flying at great speed, were wheeling and circling, and traversing all the land as if they were searching for something, and they were steadily drawing nearer.
"Lie flat and still," hissed Aragorn, pulling Sam down into the shade of a holly bush. For a whole regiment of birds had broken away suddenly from the main host and came flying low, straight towards the ridge. Sam thought they were a kind of crow of large size. As they passed overhead, in so dense a throng that their shadow followed them darkly over the ground below, one harsh croak was heard. Not until they had dwindled into the distance, north and west, and the sky was again clear, would Aragorn rise. Then he sprang up and went and wakened Gandalf. "Regiments of black crows are flying over all the land between the mountains and the grey flood," he said. "And they've passed over Holland. They are not natives here. They are Krabain out of Fangorn and Dunland. I do not know what they are about. Possibly there is some trouble away south from which they are fleeing, but I think they are spying out the land. I've also glimpsed many hawks flying high up in the sky.